hardly likely to understand how a mind, albeit not a human one, can affect the body of someone else. Of course, my skills are not just the product of biology. I have technology. But it is unseen. It is inside me, and now resides in my left hand. It allowed me to take this shape. It enables me to contact my home, and it strengthens my mind. It makes me able to manipulate mental and physical processes. I can perform telekinesis. Look, look right now, look what I'm doing with the lid of the peanut butter jar. And also something very close to hypnosis. You see, where I am from, everything is seamless. Minds, bodies, technologies all come together in a quite beautiful convergence. The phone rang at that point. It had rung earlier, too. I didn't answer it, though. There were some tastes, just as there were some songs by the Beach Boys, In My Room, God Only Knows, Sloop John B, that were just too good to disturb. But then the peanut butter ran out, and Newton and I stared at each other in mutual mourning. I'm sorry, Newton, but it appears we have run out of peanut butter.
This cannot be true. You must be mistaken. Check again.
I checked again. No, I'm not mistaken.
Properly. Check properly. That was just a glance.
I checked properly. I even showed him the inside of the jar. He was still disbelieving, so I placed the jar right up next to his nose, which was clearly where he wanted it.
Ah, you see, there is still some. Look, look.
And he licked the contents of the jar until he, too, had to eventually agree we were out of the stuff. I laughed out loud. I had never laughed. It was a very odd feeling, but not unpleasant. And then we went and sat on the sofa in the living room.
Why are you here?
I don't know if the dog's eyes were asking me this, but I gave him an answer anyway. I am here to destroy information. Information that exists in the bodies of certain machines and the minds of certain humans. That is my purpose. Although, obviously, while I'm here, I'm also collecting information. Just how volatile are they? How violent? How dangerous to themselves and others? Are their flaws, and there do seem to be quite a few, insurmountable? Or is there hope? These questions are the sort I have in mind, even if I'm not supposed to. First and foremost, though, what I am doing involves elimination. Newton looked at me bleakly, but he didn't judge. And we stayed there, on that purple sofa, for quite a while. Something was happening to me, I realized, and it had been happening ever since Debussy and the Beach Boys. I wished I'd never played them. For 10 minutes we sat in silence. This mournful mood only altered with the distraction of the front door opening and closing. It was Gulliver. He waited silently in the hallway for a moment or two, and then hung up his coat and dropped his school bag. He came into the living room, walking slowly. He didn't make eye contact.
"Don't tell Mum, okay?"
"What?" I said. "Don't tell her what?" He was awkward.
"That I wasn't at school."
"Okay, I won't." He looked at Newton, whose head was back on my lap. He seemed confused, but didn't comment. He turned to go upstairs. "What were you doing by the train track?" I asked him. I saw his hands tense up.
"What?"
"You were just standing there as the train passed."
"You followed me?"
"Yes. Yes, I did. I followed you. I wasn't going to tell you. In fact, I'm surprising myself by telling you now. But my innate curiosity won out." He answered with a kind of muted groan and headed upstairs. After a while, with a dog on your lap, you realize there is a necessity to stroke it. Don't ask me how this necessarily comes about. It clearly has something to do with the dimensions of the human upper body. Anyway, I stroked the dog, and as I did so, I realized it was actually a pleasant feeling. The warmth and the rhythm of it. Isabel's Dance. Eventually Isabel came back. I shifted along the sofa to reach such a position that I could witness her walking in through the front door. Just to see the simple effort of it, the physical pushing of the door, the extraction of the key, the closing of the door, and the placing of that key and the others it was attached to in a small oval basket on a static piece of wooden furniture. All of that was quite mesmerizing to me. The way she did such things in single gliding movements, almost dance-like, without thinking about them. I should have been looking down on such things, but I wasn't. She seemed to be continually operating above the task she was doing, a melody rising above rhythm. Yet she was still what she was, a human. She walked down the hallway, exhaling the whole way, her face containing both a smile and a frown at once. Like her son, she was confused to see the dog lying on my lap, and equally confused when she saw the dog jump off my lap and run over to her. "What's with Newton?" she asked. "With him? He seems lively."
"Does he?"
"Yes, and, I don't know, his eyes seem brighter."
"Oh, it might have been the peanut butter. And the music."
"Peanut butter? Music? You never listen to music. Have you been listening to music?"
"Yes, we have."
She looked at me with suspicion. "Right, I see.
We've been listening to music all day long."
"How are you feeling? I mean, you know, about Daniel."
"Oh, it is very sad," I said.
"How was your day?"
She sighed.
"It was okay."
This was a lie, I could tell that.
I looked at her. My eyes could stay on her with ease, I noticed. What had happened? Was this another side effect of the music?
I suppose I was getting acclimatized to her and to humans in general. Physically, at least from the outside, I was one too. It was becoming a new normality, in a sense.
Yet even so, my stomach churned far less with her than with the sight of the others I saw walking past the window, peering in at me. In fact, that day, or at that point in that day, it didn't churn at all. "I feel like I should phone Tabitha," she said. "It's difficult, though, isn't it? She'll be inundated. I might just send her an email and let her know, you know, if there's anything we can do."
I nodded. "That's a good idea."
She studied me for a while. "Yes," she said, at a lower frequency. "I think so."
She looked at the phone.
"Has anyone called?"
"I think so. The phone rang a few times."
"But you didn't pick it up?"
No, I didn't. I don't really feel up to lengthy conversations, and I feel cursed at the moment. The last time I had a lengthy conversation with anyone who wasn't you or Gulliver, they ended up dying in front of me."
"Don't say it like that."
"Like what?"
"Flippantly. It's a sad day."
"I know," I said. "I just... it hasn't sunk in yet, really."
She went away to listen to the messages. She came back. "Lots of people have been calling you."
"Oh," I said. "Who?"
"Your mother. But be warned, she might be doing her trademark oppressive worry thing. She's heard about your little event at Corpus. I don't know how. The college called, too, wanting to speak, doing a good job of sounding concerned. A journalist from the Cambridge Evening News. And Ari, being sweet. He wonders if you'd be up to going to a football match on Saturday. Someone else, too."
She paused for a moment.
"She said her name was Maggie."
"Oh, yes," I said, faking it. "Of course, Maggie."
Then she raised her eyebrows at me.
It meant something, clearly, but I had no idea what.
It was frustrating. You see, the language of words was only one of the human languages. There were many others, as I have pointed out. The language of sighs, the language of silent moments, and most significantly, the language of frowns. Then she did the opposite, her eyebrows going as low as they could. She sighed and went into the kitchen. "What have you been doing with the caster sugar?"
"Eating it," I said. "It was a mistake. Sorry."
Well, you know, feel free to put things back.
I forgot. Sorry.
It's okay. It's just been a day and a half, that's all.
I nodded and tried to act human. What do you want me to do? I mean, what should I do?
Well, you could start by calling your mother. But don't tell her about the hospital. I know what you're like.
What? What am I like?
You tell her more than you tell me.
Now that was worrying. That was very worrying indeed. I decided to phone her right away.
The mother.
Remarkable as it may sound, the mother was an important concept for humans. Not only were they truly aware who their mother was, but in many cases they also kept in contact with them throughout their lives. Of course, for someone like me, whose mother was never there to be known, this was a very exotic idea. So exotic, I was scared to pursue it. But I did, because if her son had told her too much information, I obviously needed to know.
Andrew?
Yes, Mother. It is me.
Oh, Andrew!
She spoke at a high frequency, the highest I had ever heard. Hello, Mother.
Andrew, me and your father have been worried sick about you.
Oh, I said. I had a little episode. I temporarily lost my mind. I forgot to put on my clothes, that's all.
Is that all you have to say?
No, no, it isn't. I have to ask you a question, Mother. It is an important question.
Oh, Andrew, what is the matter?
The matter? Which matter?
Is it Isabel? Has she been nagging you again? Is that what this is about?
Again? The static crackle of a sigh.
Yes, you've told us for over a year now that you and Isabel have been having difficulties, that she's not been as understanding as she could have been about your workload, that she's not been there for you.
I thought of Isabel lying about her day to stop me worrying, making me food, stroking my skin. No, I said. She is there for him, me.
And Gulliver, what about him? I thought she'd turned him against you, because of that band he wanted to be in. But you were right, darling. He shouldn't be messing around in bands, not after all that he's done.
Band? I don't know, Mother. I don't think it is that.
Why are you calling me Mother? You never call me Mother.
But you are my Mother. What do I call you?
Mum. You call me Mum.
Mum, I said. It sounded the most strange of all the strange words. Mum. 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 Listen, I want to know if I spoke to you recently. She wasn't listening.
We wish we were there.
Come over, I said. I was interested to see what she looked like. Come over right now.
Well, if we didn't live 12,000 miles away.
Oh, I said. 12,000 miles didn't sound like much. Come over this afternoon, then. The mother laughed.
Still got your sense of humour?
Yes, I said. I am still very funny. Listen, did I speak to you last Saturday?
No. Andrew, have you lost your memory? Is this amnesia? You're acting like you have amnesia.
I'm a bit confused, that's all. It's not amnesia. The doctors told me that. It's just... I have been working hard.
Yes, yes, I know. You told us.
So what did I tell you?
That you've hardly been sleeping. That you've been working harder than you ever have, at least since your PhD.
And then she started giving me information I hadn't asked for. She started talking about her hip bone. It was causing her a lot of pain. She was on pain relief medication, but it wasn't working. I found the conversation disconcerting and even nauseating. The idea of prolonged pain was quite alien to me. Humans considered themselves to be quite medically advanced, but they had yet to solve this problem in any meaningful way, just as they had yet to solve the problem of death. Mother, Mum, listen, what do you know about the Riemann hypothesis?
That's the thing you're working on, isn't it?
Working on? Working on. Yes, I am still working on it, and I will never prove it. I realise that now.
Oh, all right, darling. Well, don't beat yourself up about it. Now listen.
Pretty soon she was back to talking about the pain again.
She said the doctor had told her she should get a hip replacement. It would be made of titanium. I almost gasped when she said that, but I didn't want to tell her about titanium, as the humans obviously didn't know about that yet. They would find out in their own time. Then she started talking about my father and how his memory was getting worse. The doctor had told him not to drive any more, and that it looked increasingly unlikely that he would be able to finish the book on macroeconomic theory he had been hoping to get published.
"It makes me worry about you, Andrew. You know, only last week I told you what the doctor had said about how I should advise you to get a brain scan. It can run in families."
"Oh," I said. I really didn't know what else was required of me. The truth was that I wanted the conversation to end. I'd obviously not told my parents. Or I hadn't told my mother, at any rate. And, from the sound of things, my father's brain was such that it would probably lose any information I had given him. Also, and it was a big also, the conversation was depressing me. It was making me think about human life in a way I didn't want to think about it. Human life, I realized, got progressively worse as you got older by the sound of things. You arrived with baby feet and hands and infinite happiness, and then the happiness slowly evaporated as your feet and hands grew bigger. And then, from the teenage years onwards, happiness was something you could lose your grip of, and once it started to slip, it gained mass. It was as if the knowledge that it could slip was the thing that made it more difficult to hold, no matter how big your feet and hands were. Why was this depressing? Why did I care when it was not my job to do so? Again, I felt immense gratitude that I only looked like a human being and would never actually be one. She carried on talking, and as she did so I realized there could be no cosmic consequence at all if I stopped listening, and with that realization I switched off the phone. I closed my eyes, wanting to see nothing, but I did see something. I saw Tabitha leaning over her husband as aspirin froth slid out of his mouth. I wondered if my mother was the same age as Tabitha, or older. When I opened my eyes again, I realized Newton was standing there looking up at me. His eyes told me he was confused.
"Why did you not say goodbye? You usually say goodbye."
And then, bizarrely, I did something I didn't understand, something which had absolutely no logic to it at all. I picked up the phone and dialed the same number. After three rings, she answered, and then I spoke.
"Sorry, Mum, I meant to say goodbye."
"Hello? Hello, can you hear me? Are you there?"
"We can hear you. We are here."
"Listen, it's safe. The information is destroyed. For now, the humans will remain at level 3. There is no worry."
"You have destroyed all the evidence and all possible sources."
"I've destroyed the information on Andrew Martin's computer and on Daniel Russell's computer."
"Daniel Russell is destroyed also."
"Heart attack. He was a heart risk, so that was the most logical cause of death in the circumstances."
"Have you destroyed Isabel Martin and Gulliver Martin?"
"No. No, I haven't. There is no need to destroy them."
"They do not know."
"Gulliver Martin knows. Isabel Martin doesn't, but Gulliver has no motivation to say anything."
"You must destroy him. You must destroy both of them."
"No. There is no need. If you want me to, if you really think it is required, then I can manipulate his neurological processes. I can make him forget what his father told him. Not that he really knows, anyway, he has no real understanding of mathematics."
"The effects of any mind manipulation you carry out disappear the moment you return home. You know that."
"He won't say anything."
"He might have said something already. Humans aren't to be trusted. They don't even trust themselves."
"Gulliver hasn't said anything, and Isabel knows nothing."
"You must complete your task. If you do not complete your task, someone else will be sent to complete it for you."
"No, no,
I will complete it. Don't worry. I will complete my task. Part 2. I held a jewel in my fingers. You can't say A is made of B or vice versa. All mass is interaction. Richard Feynman. We're all lonely for something we don't know we're lonely for. David Foster Wallace. For small creatures such as we, the vastness is bearable only through love. Carl Sagan. Sleepwalking. I stood next to his bed while he slept. I don't know how long I just stood there, in the dark, listening to his deep breathing as he slipped deeper and deeper below dreams. Half an hour, maybe. He hadn't pulled the window blind down, so I looked out at the night. There was no moon from this angle, but I could see a few stars. Suns lighting dead solar systems elsewhere in the galaxy. Everywhere you can see in their sky, or almost everywhere, is lifeless. That must affect them. That must give them ideas above their station. That must send them insane. Gulliver rolled over, and I decided to wait no longer. It was now, or it was never. "You will pull back your duvet," I told him, in a voice he wouldn't have heard if he had been awake, but which reached right in, riding theta waves, to become a command from his own brain. "And slowly you will sit up in your bed, your feet will be on the rug, and you will breathe, and you will compose yourself, and then you will stand up." And he did indeed stand up. He stayed there, breathing deeply and slowly, waiting for the next command. "You will walk to the door. Do not worry about opening the door, because it is already open. There. Just walk. Just walk. Just walk to your door." He did exactly as I said. And he was there in the doorway, oblivious to everything except my voice. A voice which only had two words that needed to be said. "Fall forward." I moved closer to him. Somehow those words were slow to arrive. I needed time. Another minute, at least. I was there, closer, able to smell the scent of sleep on him. Of humanity. And I remembered, "You must complete your task. If you do not complete your task, someone else will be sent to complete it for you." I swallowed. My mouth was so dry it hurt. I felt the infinite expanse of the universe behind me, a vast, if neutral, force. The neutrality of time, of space, of mathematics, of logic, of survival. I closed my eyes, waited. Before I opened them, I was being gripped by the throat. I could barely breathe. He had turned 180 degrees, and his left hand had me by the neck. I pulled it away, and now both his hands were fists swinging at me, wild, angry, hitting me almost as much as he missed. He got the side of my head. I walked backwards away from him, but he was moving forwards at just the same speed. His eyes were open. He was seeing me now, seeing me and not seeing me all at the same time. I could have said stop, of course, but I didn't. Maybe I wanted to witness some human violence firsthand, even unconscious violence, to understand the importance of my task. By understanding it, I would be able to fulfill it. Yes, that might have been it. That may also have explained why I let myself bleed when he punched me on the nose. I'd reached his desk now and could retreat no further, so I just stood there as he kept hitting my head, my neck, my chest, my arms. He roared now, his mouth as wide as it could go, baring teeth. "Roar!" This roar woke him up. His legs went weak and he nearly fell to the floor, but he recovered in time. "Oi," he said. He didn't know where he was for a moment. He saw me in the dark, and this time it was conscious sight. "Dad?" I nodded as a slow, thin stream of blood reached my mouth. Isabel was running up the stairs to the attic.
"What's going on?"
"Nothing," I said. I heard a noise, so I came upstairs. Gulliver was sleepwalking, that's all. Isabel switched the light on, gasped as she saw my face.
You're bleeding.
It's nothing. He didn't know what he was doing.
Gulliver?
Gulliver was sitting on the edge of his bed now, flinching from the light. He too looked at my face, but he didn't say anything at all. I was a wasn't. Gulliver wanted to go back to bed, to sleep. So, 10 minutes later, Isabel and I were alone, and I was sitting on the side of the bath as she placed an antiseptic solution called TCP on a circle of cotton wool and dabbed it gently on a cut on my forehead, and then on my lip. Now, these were wounds I could have healed with a single thought. Just to feel pain sometimes was enough to cancel it. And yet, even as the antiseptic stung on contact with each cut, the injuries stayed. I forced them to. I couldn't allow her to get suspicious. But was it just that?
How's your nose? She asked.
I caught sight of it in the mirror, a smear of blood around one nostril. It's okay, I said, feeling it. It isn't broken. Her eyes squinted in pure concentration.
This one on your forehead is really bad, and there's going to be one giant bruise there. He must have really hit you hard. Did you try and restrain him?
Yes, I lied. I did, but he kept on. I could smell her. Clean, human smells. The smells of the creams she used to wash and moisturize her face. The smell of her shampoo. A delicate trace of ammonia, barely competing with the heavy scent of antiseptic. She was physically closer to me than she had ever been. I looked at her neck. She had two little dark moles on it, close together, charting unknown binary stars. I thought of Andrew Martin kissing her. This is what humans did. They kissed. Like so many human things, it made no sense. Or maybe if you tried it, the logic would unfold.
Did he say anything?
No, I said. No, he just yelled. It was very primal.
I don't know. Between you and him, it never ends.
What never ends?
The worry.
She placed the blood-stained cotton wool in the small bin beside the sink. I'm sorry, I said. I'm sorry for everything, for the past and the future. An apology, said while in dull pain, made me feel as close to human as it was possible to feel. I could almost have written a poem.
We went back to bed. She held my hand in the dark. I gently pulled it away.
We've lost him, she said.
It took me a moment to realize she was talking about Gulliver. Well, I said, maybe we just have to accept him as he is, even if he's different to what we've known.
I just don't understand him. You know, he's our son, and we've known him for 16 years, and yet I feel like I don't know him at all.
Well, maybe we should try not to understand so much and accept some more.
That's a very difficult thing, and a very strange thing to come from your mouth, Andrew.
So I suppose the next question is, what about me? Do you understand me?
I don't think you understand yourself, Andrew.
I wasn't Andrew. I knew I wasn't Andrew. But equally, I was losing myself. I wasn't. That was the problem. I was lying in bed with a human woman I could now almost appreciate as beautiful, willfully still feeling the sting of antiseptic in my wounds, and thinking of her strange but fascinating skin and the way she'd cared for me. No one in the universe cared for me.
You didn't, did you?
We had technology to care for us now, and we didn't need emotions. We were alone. We worked together for our preservation, but emotionally we needed no one. We just needed the purity of mathematical truth. And yet, I was scared of falling asleep, because the moment I fell asleep, my wounds would heal, and right then I didn't want that to happen. Right then I found a strange but real comfort in the pain.
I had so many worries now. So many questions. "Do you believe humans are ever knowable?" I asked. "I wrote a book on Charlemagne. I hope so. But humans in their natural state, are they good or are they bad, would you say? Can they be trusted? Or is their own real state just violence and greed and cruelty?" "Well, that's the oldest question there is. What do you think?"
"I'm tired, Andrew. I'm sorry."
"Yes, me too. I'll see you in the morning."
"Night."
"Night." I stayed awake for a while as Isabel slipped towards sleep. The trouble was, I still wasn't used to the night. It may not have been as dark as I first thought it to be. There was moonlight, starlight, air glow, street lamps, and sunlight backscattered by interplanetary dust. But the humans still spent half their time in deep shadow. This, I was sure, was one of the chief reasons for personal and sexual relationships here, the need to find comfort in the dark. And it was a comfort, being next to her. So I just stayed there, hearing her breath move in and out, sounding like the tide of some exotic sea. At some point, my little finger touched hers, in the double night beneath the duvet, and this time I kept it there, and imagined I was really what she thought I was, and that we were connected. Two humans, primitive enough to truly care about each other. It was a comforting thought, and the one which led me down those ever-darkening stairs of the mind towards sleep. I may need more time.
You do not need time.
I'm going to kill who I need to kill. Don't worry about that.
We are not worried.
But I'm not just here to destroy information. I'm here to gather it. That is what you said, wasn't it? Stuff on mathematical understanding can be read across the universe. I know that. I'm not talking about neuroflashes. I'm talking about stuff that can only be picked up on from here, on Earth itself, to give us more insight into how the humans live. It has been a long time since anyone was here, at least in human terms.
Explain why you need more time for this. Complexity demands time, but humans are primitives. They are the most shallow of mysteries.
No, you are wrong. They exist simultaneously in two worlds, the world of appearances and the world of truth. The connecting strands between these worlds take many forms. When I first arrived here, I did not understand certain things. For instance, I did not understand why clothes were so important, or why a dead cow became beef, or why grass cut a certain way demanded not to be walked upon, or why household pets were so important to them. The humans are scared of nature and are greatly reassured when they can prove to themselves they have mastery over it. This is why lawns exist and why wolves evolved into dogs and why their architecture is based on unnatural shapes. But really, nature, pure nature, is just a symbol to them, a symbol of human nature. They are interchangeable. So what I am saying...
What are you saying?
What I am saying is that it takes time to understand humans because they don't understand themselves. They have been wearing clothes for so long. Metaphorical clothes. That is what I'm talking about. That was the price of human civilization. To create it, they had to close the door on their true selves. And so they are lost. That is how I understand it. And that is why they invented art. Books, music, films, plays, painting, sculpture. They invented them as bridges back to themselves, back to who they are. But however close they get, they are forever removed. What I am saying, I suppose, is that last night I was about to kill the boy, Gulliver. He was about to fall down the stairs in his sleep, but then his true nature came out and he attacked me.
Attacked you with what?
With himself.
With his arms, his hands.
He was still asleep, but his eyes were open. He attacked me, or the me he thinks I am, his father, and it was pure rage.
The humans are violent,
That is not news.
No, I know, I know. But he woke and he wasn't violent. That is the battle they have.
And I believe if we understand human nature a little more, then we will know better what action to take in the future when other advances are made. In the future, when another overpopulation crisis arises, there may come a time when Earth becomes a valid option for our species. So surely, as much knowledge as possible on human psychology and society and behaviour is going to help.
They are defined by greed.
Not all of them. For instance, there is a mathematician called Grigori Perelman. He turned down money and prizes. He looks after his mother. We have a distorted view. I think it would be useful for all of us if I researched further.
But you don't need the two humans for that.
Oh, I do.
Why?
Because they think they know who I am, and I have a true chance of seeing them, the real them, behind the walls they have built for themselves. And speaking of walls, Gulliver knows nothing now. I cancelled his knowledge of what his father told him on his last night. While I am here, there is no danger.
You must act soon. You don't have forever.
I know. Don't worry, I won't need forever.
They must die.
Yes.
Wider than the sky.
It was sleep psychosis,
Isabel told Gulliver at breakfast the next day.
It was very common. Lots of people have had it. Lots of perfectly normal and sane people. Like that man from REM, he had it, and he was meant to be as nice as rock stars come.
She hadn't seen me. I just entered the kitchen. But now she noticed my presence and was puzzled by the sight of me.
Your face, she said. Last night there were cuts and bruises. It's totally healed.
Must have been better than it looked. The night might exaggerate things.
Yes, but even so.
She glanced at her son, struggling uneasily with his cereal, and decided not to go on.
You might need the day off school, Gulliver, said Isabel.
I expected him to agree to this, seeing that he preferred an education that involved staring at rail tracks. But he looked at me, considered for a moment, and concluded,
No. No, it's okay. I feel fine.
Later, it was just me and Newton in the house. I was still recovering, you see.
Recover.
The most human of words, the implication being that healthy, normal life is covering something. The violence that is there underneath. The violence I had seen in Gulliver the night before. To be healthy meant to be covered. Clothed. Literally and metaphorically. Yet I needed to find what lay beneath, something that would satisfy the hosts and justify the delay I was taking in my task. I discovered a pile of paper tied with an elastic band. It was in Isabel's wardrobe, hidden among all those essential clothes, yellowing with age. I sniffed the page and guessed at least a decade. The top sheet had the words Wider Than the Sky on them, along with these ones, a novel by Isabel Martin.
A novel?
I read a little bit of it and realized that although the central character's name was Charlotte, she could just as easily have been called Isabel. Charlotte heard herself sigh, a tired old machine releasing pressure. Everything weighed down on her. The small rituals of her daily existence, filling the dishwasher, picking up from school, cooking, had all been performed as if under water. The mutual energy reserve shared by a mother and her child had now, she conceded, been monopolized by Oliver. He had been running wild since she had picked him up from school, firing that blue alien blaster or whatever it was. She didn't know why her mother had bought it. Actually, she did know. To prove a point.
5-year-old boys want to play with guns, Charlotte. It's only natural. You can't deprive them of their nature. Die, die, die!
Charlotte closed the oven door and set the timer.
She turned around to see Oliver pointing the massive blue gun up at her face.
No, Oliver, she said, too tired to battle the abstract anger clouding his features. Don't shoot, Mummy.
He maintained his pose, fired cheap electric fairground sounds a few more times, then ran out of the kitchen, through the hallway, and noisily exterminated invisible aliens as he charged up the stairs. She remembered the quiet, echoing babble of university corridors, and realized that missing it was a kind of pain. She wanted to return, to teach again, but she worried she may have left it too late. Maternity leave had stretched into permanent leave, and the belief had grown that she could be fulfilled as a wife and mother, a historical archetype, keeping her feet on the ground, as her mother always advised, while her high-flying husband made sure he didn't dip beneath the clouds. Charlotte shook her head in theatrical exasperation, as if she were being observed by an audience of stern-faced mother watchers examining her progress and making notes on clipboards. She was often aware of the self-conscious nature of her parenting, the way she had to create a role outside of herself, a part already plotted out for her. Don't shoot Mummy. She squatted down and looked through the oven door. The lasagna would be another 45 minutes, and Jonathan still wasn't back from his conference. She raised herself back up and went into the living room. The wobbly glass of the drinks cabinet glinted, shining like a false promise. She turned the old key and opened the door. A mini metropolis of spirit bottles bathed in dark shadow. She reached for the Empire State, the Bombay Sapphire, and poured out her evening allowance. Jonathan. Late last Thursday, late this Thursday. She acknowledged this fact as she slumped down on the settee, but did not get too close to it. Her husband was a mystery she no longer had the energy to unravel. Anyway, it was known to be the first rule of marriage. Solve the mystery, end the love. So, families often stayed together. Wives sometimes managed to stay with husbands and put up with whichever misery they felt by writing novels and hiding them at the bottom of their wardrobes. Mothers put up with their children, no matter how difficult those children were, no matter how close to insanity they pushed their parents. Anyway, I stopped reading there. I felt it was an intrusion. A bit rich, I know, from someone who was living inside her husband's identity. I put it back in its place in the wardrobe, underneath the clothes. Later on, I told her what I had found. She gave me an unreadable look, and her cheeks went red. I didn't know if it was a blush or anger. Maybe it was a little of both.
That was private. You weren't ever supposed to see that.
I know. That is why I wanted to see it. I want to understand you.
Why? There's no academic glory or million-dollar prize if you solve me, Andrew. You shouldn't go snooping around.
Shouldn't a husband know a wife?
That really is quite rich coming from you.
What does that mean? She sighed.
Nothing. Nothing. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that.
You should say whatever you feel you should say.
Good policy, but I think that would mean we'd have divorced around 2002 at a conservative estimate.
Well, maybe you would have been happier if you had divorced him, I mean me, in 2002.
Well, we'll never know.
No. And the phone rang. It was someone for me. Hello? A man spoke. His voice was casual, familiar, but there was a curiosity there too.
Hey, it's me, Ari.
Oh, hello, Ari. I knew Ari was supposed to be my closest friend, so I tried to sound friend-like. How are you? How's your marriage? Isabel looked at me with an emphatic frown, but I don't think he'd heard properly.
Well, just got back from that thing in Edinburgh.
Oh, I said, trying to pretend I knew what that thing in Edinburgh was.
Right, yes, that thing in Edinburgh, of course. How was that?
It was good. Yeah, it was good. Caught up with St. Andrew's lot. Listen, mate, I hear it's been a bit of a week for you.
Yes, it has. It has been a lot of a week for me.
So I wasn't sure if you'd still be up for the football.
The football?
Cambridge Kettering. We could have a pint of mild and a bit of a chat about that top secret thing you told me the last time we spoke.
Secret? Every molecule of me was now alert.
What secret?
Don't think I should broadcast it.
No. No, you're right. Don't say it out loud. In fact, don't tell anyone.
Isabel was now in the hallway, looking at me with suspicion.
But to answer you, yes, I will go to the football.
And I pressed the red button on the phone, weary at the probability that I would have to switch another human life into non-existence. A few seconds of silence over breakfast.
You become something else. A different species.
That is the easy bit. That is simple molecular rearrangement. Our inner technology can do that without a problem with the correct commands and model to work from. There are no new ingredients in the universe, and humans, however they may look, are made of roughly the same things we are. The difficulty, though, is the other stuff. The stuff that happens when you look in the bathroom mirror and see this new you and don't want to throw up into the sink at the sight of yourself like you've wanted to every other morning. And when you wear clothes and you realize it is starting to feel like quite a normal thing to do. And when you walk downstairs and see the life form that is meant to be your son eating toast, listening to music only he can hear, it takes you a second, or two, three, 4 seconds, to realize that actually this is not your son. He means nothing to you. Not only that, he has to mean nothing to you. Also, your wife. Your wife is not your wife. Your wife who loves you but doesn't really like you because of something you never did, but which couldn't be any worse from her perspective than the something you're going to do. She is an alien. She is as alien as they come, a primate whose nearest evolutionary cousins are hairy, tree-dwelling knuckle-draggers known as chimpanzees. And yet, when everything is alien, the alien becomes familiar, and you can judge her as humans judge her. You can watch her when she drinks her pink grapefruit juice and stares at her son with worried, helpless eyes. You can see that for her, being a parent is standing on a shore and watching her child in a vulnerable craft, heading out over deeper and deeper water, hoping but not knowing there will be land somewhere ahead. And you can see her beauty. If beauty on Earth is the same as elsewhere. Ideal in that it is tantalizing and unsolvable, creating a delicious kind of confusion. I was confused. I was lost. I wished I had a new wound just so she could attend to me.
What are you looking at? She asked me.
You, I said.
She looked at Gulliver. He couldn't hear us. Then she looked back at me, as confused as myself.
We are worried. What are you doing?
I told you.
Well?
I am accumulating information.
You are wasting time.
I'm not. I know what I'm doing.
It was never meant to take this long.
I know, but I'm learning more about the humans. They are more complicated than we first thought.
They are sometimes violent, but more often care about each other.
There is more goodness in them than anything else. I am convinced of it.
What are you saying?
I don't know what I'm saying. I am confused. Some things have stopped making sense.
This happens occasionally on a new planet. The perspective changes to that of its inhabitants. But our perspective has not changed. Do you understand that?
Yes. I do understand.
Stay pure.
I will.
Life, death, football.
Humans are one of the few intelligent beings in the galaxy who haven't quite solved the problem of death. And yet they don't spend their whole lives screeching and howling in terror, clawing at their own bodies or rolling around on the floor. Some humans do that. I saw them in the hospital. But those humans are considered the mad ones. Now, consider this. A human life is, on average, 80 Earth years, or around 30,000 Earth days. Which means they're born, they make some friends, eat a few meals, they get married or they don't get married, have a child or two or not, drink a few thousand glasses of wine, have sexual intercourse a few times, discover a lump somewhere, feel a bit of regret, wonder where all the time went, know they should have done it differently, realize they would have done it the same, and then they die. Into the great black nothing. Out of space. Out of time. The most trivial of trivial zeros. And that's it. The full caboodle. All confined to the same mediocre planet. But at ground level, the humans don't appear to spend their entire lives in a catatonic state. No. They do other things. Things like washing, listening, gardening, eating, driving, working, yearning, earning, staring, drinking, sighing, reading, gaming, sunbathing, complaining, jogging, quibbling, caring, mingling, fantasizing, googling, parenting, renovating, loving, dancing, fucking, regretting, failing, striving, hoping, sleeping. Oh, and sport. Apparently I, or rather Andrew, liked sport, and the sport he liked was football. Luckily for Professor Andrew Martin, the football team he supported was Cambridge United, one of those which successfully avoided the perils and existential trauma of victory. To support Cambridge United, I discovered, was to support the idea of failure. To watch a team's feet consistently avoid the spherical Earth symbol seemed to frustrate their supporters greatly, but they obviously wouldn't have had it any other way. The truth is, you see, however much they would beg to disagree, humans don't actually like to win. Or rather, they like winning for 10 seconds, but if they keep on winning, they end up actually having to think about other things, like life and death. The only thing humans like less than winning is losing, but at least something can be done about that. With absolute winning, there is nothing to be done. They just have to deal with it. Now, I was there at the game to see Cambridge United play against a team called Kettering. I'd asked Gulliver if he wanted to come with me, so I could keep an eye on him, and he had said, with sarcasm, "Yeah, Dad, you know me so well." So it was just me and Ari, or to give him his full title, Professor Ari Rumadi Arasaratham. As I've said, this was Andrew's closest friend, although I had learned from Isabel that I didn't really have friends as such, more acquaintances. Anyway, Ari was an expert, human definition, on theoretical physics. He was also quite rotund, as if he didn't just want to watch football, but become one. "So," he said, during a period when Cambridge United didn't have the ball, that is to say, any time during the match, "how are things?" "Things?" He stuffed some crisps into his mouth and made no attempt to conceal their fate.
"You know, I was a bit worried about you."
He laughed. It was the laugh human males do to hide emotion.
"Well, I say worry, it was more mild concern. I say mild concern, but it was more, wonder if he's done a nash."
"What do you mean?" He told me what he meant. Apparently, human mathematicians have a habit of going mad. He gave me a list of names. Nash, Cantor, Gödel, Turing. And I nodded along as if they meant something. And then he said,
"Riemann."
"Riemann?"
"I heard you weren't eating much, so I was thinking more Gödel than Riemann, actually," he said.
By Gödel, I later learnt, he meant Kurt Gödel, another German mathematician. However, this one's particular psychological quirk was that he had believed everyone was trying to poison his food, so he had stopped eating altogether. By that definition of madness, Ari appeared very sane indeed.
No, I haven't done one of those. I'm eating now. Peanut butter sandwiches, mainly.
Sounds like more of a Presley, he said, laughing.
And then he gave me a serious look. I could tell it was serious because he had swallowed and wasn't putting any more food in his mouth.
Because, you know, prime numbers are fucking serious, man. Some serious shit. They can make you lose it. They're like sirens. They call you in with their isolated beauty, and before you know it, you're in some major mind shit.
When I heard about your naked corpus at Corpus, I thought you were cracking up a bit. No, I'm on the rails, I said. Like a train, or a clothes hanger.
And Isabel? Everything fine with you and Isabel?
Yes, I said. She is my wife, and I love her. Everything is fine. Fine. He frowned at me. Then he took a moment's glance to see if Cambridge United were anywhere near the ball. He seemed relieved to see they weren't.
Really? Everything's fine?
I could see he needed more confirmation. Till I loved, I never lived. He shook his head and gave a facial expression I can now safely classify as bewilderment.
What's that? Shakespeare? Tennyson? Marvell?
I shook my head. No, it was Emily Dickinson. I've been reading a lot of her poetry, and also Anne Sexton's, and Walt Whitman, too. Poetry seems to say a lot about us. You know, us humans.
Emily Dickinson? You're quoting Emily Dickinson as a match?
Yes. I sensed again I was getting the context wrong. Everything here was about context. There was nothing that was right for every occasion. I didn't get it. The air always had hydrogen in it wherever you were. But that was pretty much the only consistent thing. What was the big difference that made quoting love poetry inappropriate in this context? I had no idea.
Right,
he said, and paused for the large communal groan as Kettering scored a goal. I groaned too. Groaning was actually quite diverting, and certainly the most enjoyable aspect of sport spectating. I might have overdone it a little bit, though, judging from the looks I was getting. Or maybe they'd seen me on the internet.
Okay, he said. And what does Isabel feel about everything?
Everything?
You, Andrew, what does she think? Does she know about... you know? Is that what triggered it?
This was my moment. I inhaled. The secret I told you?
Yeah.
About the Riemann hypothesis. He scrunched his face in confusion.
What? No, man. Unless you've been sleeping with a hypothesis on the side.
So what was the secret?
That you're having it away with a student.
Oh, I said, feeling relief. So I definitely didn't say anything about work the last time I saw you.
No, for once you didn't.
He turned back to the football.
So are you going to spill the beans about this student?
My memory is a bit hazy, to be honest with you.
That's convenient.
Perfect alibi, if Isabel finds out. Not that you're exactly man of the match in her eyes. What do you mean?
No offence, mate. But you've told me what her opinion is.
What is her opinion of... I hesitated. Of me? He pressed one final handful of crisps in his mouth and washed it down with that disgusting phosphoric acid-flavoured drink called Coca-Cola.
Her opinion is that you are a selfish bastard.
Why does she think that?
Maybe because you are a selfish bastard...
But then we're all selfish bastards. Are we?
Oh, yeah. It's our DNA. Dawkins pointed that out to us way back. But you, man, your selfish gene is on a different level. With you, I should imagine, your selfish gene is similar to the one that smashed a rock over the head of that penultimate Neanderthal before turning round and screwing his wife.
He smiled and carried on watching the match. It was a long match. Elsewhere in the universe, stars formed and others ceased to be. Was this the purpose of human existence?
Was the purpose somewhere inside the pleasure, or at least the casual simplicity, of a football match? Eventually the game ended. That was great, I lied, as we walked out of the grounds. Was it? We lost 4-0. Yes, but while I watched it, I didn't think once about my mortality or the various other difficulties our mortal form will bring in later life. He looked bewildered again. He was going to say something, but he was beaten to it by someone throwing an empty can at my head. Even though it was thrown from behind, I had sensed it coming and ducked quickly out of the way. Ari was stunned by my reflexes. As I think was the can thrower.
"Oi, wanker!" the can thrower said. "You're that freak on the web, the naked one. Bit warm, ain't ya, with all those clothes on?"
"Piss off, mate,"
Ari said nervously. The man did the opposite. The can thrower was walking over. He had red cheeks and very small eyes and greasy black hair. He was flanked by two friends. All three of them had faces ready for violence. Red Cheeks leaned in close to Ari.
"What did you say, big man?"
"There might have been a piss in there," said Ari, "and there was definitely an off."
The man grabbed Ari's coat.
"Think you're smart?"
"Moderately."
I held the man's arm.
"Get off me, you fucking perv," he responded. "I was speaking to Fat Bastard."
I wanted to hurt him. I'd never wanted to hurt.